The Enormous Space by J.G. Ballard. I made my decision this morning, soon after 8 o'clock, as I stood by the front door, ready to drive to the office. All in all, I'm certain that I had no other choice. Yet, given that this is the most important decision of my life, it seems strange that nothing has changed. I expected the walls to tremble at the very least a subtle shift in the perspectives of these familiar rooms. In a sense, the lack of any response reflects the tranquil air of this London suburb. If I were living not in Croydon, but in the Bronx or West Beirut, my action would be no more than sensible local camouflage. Here, it runs counter to every social value, but is invisible to those it most offends. Even now, 3 hours later, all is calm. The leafy avenue is as unruffled as ever. The mail has arrived, and sits unopened on the hall stand. From the dining room window, I watch the British Telecom engineer return to his van after repairing the Johnson's telephone, an instrument reduced to a nervous wreck at least twice a month by their teenage daughters. Mrs. Johnson, dressed in her turquoise tracksuit, closes the gate and glances at my car. A faint vapor rises from the exhaust. The engine is still idling all these hours after I began to demist the windscreen before finishing my breakfast. This small slip may give the game away. Watching the car impatiently, I am tempted to step from the house and switch off the ignition, but I manage to control myself. Whatever happens, I must hold to my decision and all the consequences that flow from it. Fortunately, an Air India 747 ambles across the sky, searching none too strenuously for London Airport. Mrs. Johnson, who shares something of its heavy-bodied elegance, gazes up at the droning turbofans. She is dreaming of Martinique or Mauritius, while I am dreaming of nothing. My decision to dream that dream may have been made this morning, but I assumed that its secret logic had begun to run through my life many months ago. Some unknown source of strength sustained me through the unhappy period of my car accident, convalescence, and divorce, and the unending problems that faced me at the merchant bank on my return. Standing by the front door after finishing my coffee, I watched the mist clear from the Volvo's windscreen. The briefcase in my hand reminded me of the day-long meetings of the finance committee at which I would have to argue once again for the budget of my beleaguered research department. Then, as I set the burglar alarm, I realized that I could change the course of my life by a single action: to shut out the world and solve all my difficulties at a stroke. I had the simplest of weapons, my own front door. I needed only to close it and decide never to leave my house again. Of course, this decision involved more than becoming a mere stay-at-home. I remember walking into the kitchen, surprised by this sudden show of strength, and trying to work out the implications of what I had done. Still wearing my business suit and tie, I sat at the kitchen table and tapped out my Declaration of Independence on the polished formica. By closing the front door, I intended to secede not only from the society around me, I was rejecting my friends and colleagues, my accountant, doctor and solicitor, and above all, my ex-wife. I was breaking off all practical connections with the outside world. I would never again step through the front door. I would accept the air and the light and the electric power and water that continued to flow through the meters. But otherwise, I would depend on the outside world for nothing. I would eat only whatever food I could find within the house. After that, I would rely on time and space to sustain me. The Volvo's engine is still running. It is 3 p.m., 7 hours after I first switched on the ignition, but I can't remember when I last filled the tank. It's remarkable how few passers-by have noticed the puttering exhaust. Only the retired headmaster who patrols the avenue morning and afternoon actually stopped to stare at it. I watched him mutter to himself and shake his walking stick before shuffling away. The murmur of the engine unsettles me, like the persistent ringing of the telephone. I can guess who is calling. Brenda, my secretary. The head of marketing. Dr. Barnes, the personal manager. Mr. Austin. I've already been on sick leave for 3 weeks. The dental receptionist, a tender root canal, reminds me that I had an appointment yesterday. My wife's solicitor, insisting that the first of the separation payments is due in 6 months' time. Finally, I pick up the telephone cable and pull the jack on this persistent din. Calming myself, I accept that I will admit to the house anyone with a legitimate right to be there. The TV rental man, the gas and electricity meter readers, even the local police. I cannot expect to be left completely on my own. At the same time, it will be months before my action arouses any real suspicions, and I am confident that by then I will long since have moved into a different realm. I feel tremendously buoyant, almost light-headed. Nothing matters anymore. Think only of the essentials, the physics of the gyroscope, the flux of photons, the architecture of very large structures. 5 p.m. Time to take stock and work out the exact resources of this house in which I have lived for 7 years. First, I carry my unopened mail into the dining room, open a box of matches, and start a small, satisfying fire in the grate. To the flames, I add the contents of my briefcase, all the banknotes in my wallet, credit cards, driving license, and checkbook. I inspect the kitchen and pantry shelves. Before leaving, Margaret had stocked the freezer and refrigerator with a fortnight supply of eggs, ham, and other bachelor staples, a pointed gesture, bearing in mind that she was about to sail off into the blue with her lover, a tedious sales manager. These basic rations fulfill the same role as the keg of fresh water and sack of flour left at the feet of a marooned sailor, a reminder of the world rejecting him. I weigh the few cartons of pasta in my hand, the jars of lentils and rice, the tomatoes and courgettes, the rope of garlic. Along with the tinned anchovies and several sachets of smoked salmon in the freezer, there are enough calories and protein to keep me going for at least 10 days, 3 times that period if I ration myself. After that, I will have to boil the cardboard boxes into a nutritious broth and rely on the charity of the wind. At 6:15, the car's engine falters and stops. In every way, I am marooned, but a reductive Crusoe, paring away exactly those elements of bourgeois life which the original Robinson so dutifully reconstituted. Crusoe wishing to bring the Croydons of his own day to life again on his island. I want to expel them and find in their place a far richer realm formed from the elements of light, time, and space. The first week has ended peacefully. All is well, and I have stabilized my regime most pleasantly. To my surprise, it has been remarkably easy to reject the world. Few people have bothered me. The postman has delivered several parcels, which I carry straight to the dining room fireplace. On the third day, my secretary, Brenda, called at the front door. I smiled winningly, reassured her that I was merely taking an extended sabbatical. She looked at me in her sweet but shrewd way. She'd been strongly supportive during both my divorce and the crisis at the office, and then left with a promise to keep in touch. A succession of letters had arrived from Dr. Barnes, but I warmed my hands over them in the fireplace. The dining room grate has become an efficient incinerator in which I have erased my entire past. Passport, birth, degree, and share certificates, uncashed traveler's checks, and 2,000 French francs left from our last unhappy holiday in Nice. Letters from my broker and orthopedic surgeon. Documents of a dead past. They come to life briefly in the flame and then write themselves into the dust. Eliminating this detritus has kept me busy. I've pulled down the heavy curtains that hung beside the windows. Light has flooded into the rooms, turning every wall and ceiling into a vivid tabula rasa. Margaret had taken with her most of the ornaments and knick-knacks, and the rest I have heaved into a cupboard. Suffused with light, the house can breathe. Upstairs, the windows are open to the sky. The rooms seem larger and less confined, as if they too have found freedom. I sleep well, and when I wake in the morning, I almost feel myself on some Swiss mountaintop with half the sky below me. Without doubt, I am very much better. I have put away the past, a zone that I regret ever entering. I enjoy the special ease that comes from no longer depending on anyone else, however well-intentioned. Above all, I am no longer dependent on myself. I feel no obligation to that person who fed and groomed me, who provided me with expensive clothes, who drove me about in his motor car, who furnished my mind with intelligent books and exposed me to interesting films and art exhibitions. Wanting none of these, I owe that person, myself, no debts. I am free at last to think only of the essential elements of existence, the visual continuum around me and the play of air and light. The house begins to resemble an advanced mathematical surface, a three-dimensional chessboard. The pieces have yet to be placed, but I feel them forming in my mind. A policeman is approaching the house. A uniformed constable, he has stepped from a patrol car parked by the gate. He looks up at the roof, watched by an elderly couple who seem to have summoned him. Confused, I debate whether to answer the doorbell. My arms and shirt are streaked with soot from the fireplace. "Mr. Ballantyne?" A rather naive young constable is looking me up and down. "Are you the householder?" "Can I help you, officer?" I assume the convincing pose of a law-abiding suburbanite, interrupted in that act of lay worship, do-it-yourself. "We've had a report of break-in, sir. Your upstairs windows have been open all night, for two or three nights, your neighbors say. They thought you might be away." "A break-in?" This throws me. "No, I've been here. In fact, I'm not planning to go out at all. I'm cleaning the chimneys, officer, getting rid of all that old soot and dust." "Fair enough." He hesitates before leaving, nose roving about for some irregularity he has sniffed, like a dog convinced of a hidden treat. He is certain that in some reprehensible way I am exploiting the suburban norms like a wife-beater or a child molester. I wait until he drives away, disappearing into that overworked hologram called reality. Afterwards, I lean against the door, exhausted by this false alarm. The effort of smiling at the officer reminds me of the interior distance I have travelled in the past week. But I must be careful and hide behind those facades of conventional behaviour that I intend to subvert. I close the windows that face the street and then step with relief into the open bedrooms above the garden. The walls form sections of huge box antenna turned to the light. I think of the concrete inclines of the old racing track at Brooklands and the giant chambers excavated from the bauxite cliffs at Leibau, where Margaret first began to distance herself from me. Of course a break-in has occurred, of a very special kind. A month has passed, a period of many advances and a few setbacks. Resting in the kitchen beside the empty refrigerator, I eat the last of the anchovies and take stock of myself. I have embarked on a long internal migration, following a route partly inscribed within my head and partly within this house, which is a far more complex structure than I realized. I have a sense that there are more rooms than there appeared to be at first sight. There is a richness of interior space of which I was totally unaware during the 7 years I spent here with Margaret. Light floods everything, expanding the dimensions of wall and ceiling. These quiet streets were built on the site of the old Croydon Aerodrome, and it is almost as if the perspectives of the former grass runways have returned to haunt these neat suburban lawns and the minds of those who tend them. All this excitement has led me to neglect my rationing system. Scarcely anything is left in the pantry. A box of sugar cubes, a tube of tomato paste, and a few shriveled asparagus tips. I lick my fingers and run them around the bottom of the empty bread bin. Already I find myself wishing that I had fully provisioned myself before embarking on this expedition. But everything I have achieved, the huge sense of freedom, of open doors, and of other doors yet to be opened, were contingent on my acting upon that decision of a moment. Even so, I have to be careful not to give the game away. I maintain a reasonably kempt appearance, wave from the upstairs windows at Mrs. Johnson, and gesture apologetically at the overgrown lawn. She understands. I have been abandoned by my wife, condemned to the despair of a womanless world. I am hungry all the time. kept going by not so much more than cups of sweetened tea. My weight has plunged. I have lost some 15 pounds and feel permanently light-headed. Meanwhile, the outside world continues to bombard me with its irrelevant messages. Junk mail, giveaway newspapers, and a barrage of letters from Dr. Barnes and the personnel department at the bank. They burn with heavy, solemn flames, and I assume that I have been sacked. Brenda called to see me 3 days ago, still puzzled by my cheerful demeanor. She told me that she had been reassigned and that my office has been cleared of its files and furniture. The letter slot rattles. From the doormat, I pick up 2 leaflets and a plastic envelope, a free sample of a new brand of chocolate. I rip it from the packing and sink my teeth into the rubbery core, unable to control the saliva that swamps my mouth. I'm so overwhelmed by the taste of food that I fail to hear the doorbell chiming. When I open the door, I find a smartly dressed woman in tweed suit and hat, presumably some solicitor's wife working as a volunteer almoner for the local hospital. "Yes, can I?" With an effort, I recognize her as I lick the last of the chocolate from my teeth. "Margaret." "Of course," she shakes her head, as if this trivial social gaffe explains everything about me. "Who on earth did you think I was? Are you all right, Jeffrey?" "Yes, I'm fine. I've been very busy. What are you looking for?" A frightening prospect crosses my mind. "You don't expect to come back?" "Good heavens, no. Dr. Barnes telephoned me. He said that you'd resigned. I'm surprised." "No, I decided to leave. I'm working on a private project. It's what I've always wanted to do." "I know." Her eyes search the hall and kitchen, convinced that something has changed. "By the way, I've paid the electricity bill, but this is the last time." "Fair enough. Well, I must get back to work." "Good." She is clearly surprised by my self-sufficiency. "You've lost weight. It suits you." The house relaxes its protective hold on me. When Margaret has gone, I reflect on how quickly I have forgotten her. There are no tugs of old affection. I have changed. My senses tuned to all the wavelengths of the invisible. Margaret has remained in a more limited world, one of a huge cast of repertory players in that everlasting provincial melodrama called Ordinary Life. Eager to erase her memory, I set off upstairs and open the windows to enjoy the full play of afternoon sun. The west-facing rooms above the garden have become giant observatories. The dust cloaks everything with a mescaline haze of violet light, photons backing up as they strike the surface of windowsill and dressing table. Margaret has taken many pieces of furniture with her, leaving unexpected gaps and intervals, as if this is a reversed spatial universe, the template of the one we occupied together. I can almost sit down in her absent William Morris chair, nearly see myself reflected in the missing Art Deco mirror whose chromium rim has left a halo on the bathroom wall. A curious discovery, the rooms are larger. At first, I thought that this was an illusion brought about by the sparse furnishings, but the house has always been bigger than I realized. My eyes now see everything as it is, uncluttered by the paraphernalia of conventional life, as in those few precious moments when one returns from holiday and sees one's home in its true light. Dazed by the vivid air, I blunder into Margaret's bedroom. The walls are strangely displaced, as if a team of scene shifters have pulled them back to create a new stage set. There is no sign of the bed, and its bare mattress marked by the wine I spilled on the evening of her departure while commiserating over her dull lover. I have strayed into an unfamiliar area of the room, somewhere between Margaret's bathroom and the fitted cupboards. The remainder of the room shears away from me, the walls pushed back by the light. For the first time I see the bed, but it seems as remote as an old divan at the rear of an empty warehouse. Another door leads to a wide and silent corridor, clearly unentered for years. There is no staircase, but far away there are entrances to other rooms, filled with a sort of light that glows from X-ray viewing screens. Here and there, an isolated chair sits against a wall. In one immense room, there is nothing but a dressing table. In another, the gleaming cabinet of a grandfather clock presides over the endlessly carpeted floor. The house is revealing itself to me in the most subtle way. Surprised by its perspectives, I trip over my own feet and feel my heart race ahead of me. I find a wall and press my hands to the striped paper, then fumble through the overlit air towards the landing. At last, I reach the top of a huge staircase whose banisters shrink together as I race to the safety of the floor below. The true dimensions of this house may be exhilarating to perceive, but from now on, I will sleep downstairs. Time and space are not necessarily on my side. I have trapped a cat. So unnerved was I by the experience of losing myself in my own home that it takes me half an hour to realize that I have a small companion, Mrs. Johnson's white Persian. While I was blundering around the Marienbad Palace that now occupies the first floor, the cat entered the sitting room through the open French window and was trapped when a gust of air closed the door. She follows me around amiably, waiting to be fed, but for once I am in need of her charity. 2 months have now passed. This conventional suburban villa is in fact the junction between our small illusory world and another larger and more real one. Miraculously, I have survived, though my last reserves of food were exhausted weeks ago. As I expected, Margaret paid a second and final visit. Still puzzled by my self-confidence and handsomely slimming figure, she told me that she would no longer be responsible for my mounting debts. I bade her farewell and returned to my lunch of poodle pie. The thought that I would never see Margaret again gave my modest meal an added relish, and afterwards I carefully set the dog trap by the open door of the sitting room. The untended garden with its knee-deep grass has attracted my neighbor's pets, trusting beasts who trundle happily towards me as I sit smiling in the armchair, cleaver concealed within an inviting cushion. By the time their ever-hopeful owners call round a few days later, I have safely consigned the bones to the space below the dining room floorboards, a substantial ossuary that is the last resting place of Bonzo, Major, Yorkie, and Mr. Fred. These dogs and cats and a few birds I have been able to trap soon formed my sole fare. However, it became clear that my neighbors were keeping a more careful eye on their pets, and I resigned myself to a diet of air. Fortunately, the television rental company intervened to provide a generous source of extra rations. I remember the dour young man with the toolkit who arrived to dismantle the attic aerial. He had made several earlier calls in the avenue and had parked his van 100 yards away. I followed him up the stairs, concerned that he too might lose his way amongst those vast rooms. Sadly, my attempt to warn him came to nothing. As he stepped into the first of those white chambers, as large as aircraft hangars carved in the roof of an iceberg, he seemed to realize that he had entered a zone of danger. I grappled with him as we blundered through that white world like Arctic explorers, losing all sense of distance within a few steps of their tent. An hour later, when I had calmed his fears and carried him down the staircase, he had sadly yielded to the terrors of light and space. 3 months, a period of continued discovery and few interruptions. The outside world has at last decided to leave me alone. I no longer answer the door, and there has been scarcely a caller, though threatening letters arrive from the local council and from the water and electricity companies. But an unshakable logic is at work, and I am confident that my project will be complete before the power and water supplies are disconnected. The house enlarges itself around me. The invasion of light which revealed its true dimensions has now reached the ground floor. To keep my bearings, I have been forced to retreat into the kitchen, where I have moved my mattress and blankets. Now and then I venture into the hall and search the looming perspectives. It amazes me that Margaret and I once lived in this vast pile and so reduced it in our minds. Already I can feel the walls of the kitchen distancing themselves from me. I spend all day here, sitting on the floor against the freezer cabinet. The cooker, refrigerator, and dishwasher have become anonymous objects in some remote department store display. How much longer can this expansion continue? Sooner or later the process will halt, at that moment revealing the true dimensions of the world we inhabit, and which the visual centers of our timid brains have concealed from us. I am on the verge of a unique revelation, the equal, perhaps, of Columbus's discovery of the New World. I can scarcely wait to bring the news to my neighbors. The modest villa which Mrs. Johnson imagines herself to occupy is, in fact, an immense Versailles. Nearby, the bones of the TV repairman lie on the yellow linoleum like the ribs and skull of a long-decayed desert traveller. Somewhere a door is being forced. I listen to the grating of keys testing a lock, then the sound of heels on the patio steps before a second attempt to prise open the French window. Rousing myself, I sway across the kitchen, trying to steady my arms against the faraway washing machine. A key turns, and a door opens somewhere beyond the great carpeted perspectives of the sitting room. A young woman has entered the house. As she returns the keys to her handbag, I recognize Brenda, my former secretary. She stares at the dismantled dog traps beside the window, and then peers around the room, at last seeing me as I watch her beside the door. "Mr. Ballantyne, I'm sorry to break in. I was worried that you might..." She smiles reassuringly and takes the keys from her handbag. "Mrs. Ballantyne said I could use the spare set. You haven't answered the phone, and we wondered if you'd fallen ill." She is walking towards me, but so slowly that the immense room seems to carry her away from me in its expanding dimensions. She approaches and recedes from me at the same time. I am concerned that she will lose herself in the almost planetary vastness of this house. Catching her as she swerves past me, I protect her from the outward rush of time and space. I assume that we have entered the fourth month. I can no longer see the calendar on the kitchen door, so remote is it from me. I am sitting with my back to the freezer, which I have moved out of the kitchen into the pantry, but already the walls of this once tiny room constitute a universe of their own. The ceiling is so distant that clouds might form below it. I have eaten nothing for the past week, but I no longer dare to leave the pantry and rarely venture more than a step from my position. I could easily lose my way crossing the kitchen and never be able to return to the only security and companionship that I know. There is only one further retreat. So much space has receded from me that I must be close to the irreducible core where reality lies. This morning, I gave in briefly to the sudden fear that all this has been taking place within my own head. By shutting out the world, my mind may have drifted into a realm without yardsticks or sense of scale. For so many years, I have longed for an empty world and may unwittingly have constructed it within this house. Time and space have rushed in to fill the vacuum that I created. It even occurred to me to end the experiment, and I stood up and tried to reach the front door, a journey that seemed as doomed as Scott's return from the South Pole. Needless to say, I was forced to give up the attempt long before crossing the threshold of the hall. Behind me, Brenda lies comfortably, her face only a few inches from my own, but now she too is beginning to move away from me. Covered by a jeweled frost, she rests quietly in the compartment of the freezer, a queen waiting one day to be reborn from her cryogenic sleep. The perspective lines flow from me, enlarging the interior of the compartment. Soon, I will lie beside her, in a palace of ice that will crystallize around us, finding at last the still center of the world which came to claim me.